There's a limit to what the dogs can do, and we're pushing the boundaries right now. I don't know if we're there yet.
The Iditarod leaders set a fast pace on the trail. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 8th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a controversial Board of Game decision that affects Denali Wolves.
It's not a popularity contest. It's not how many proposals come in on a certain issue. It's the range of things that can be considered that they discuss and then they make a choice.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
This year's Iditarod is shaping up to be a fast one. The leaders are already out of the Rainy Pass checkpoint. Whitehorse musher Sebastian Schnula is in front. He left the checkpoint at 2:20 this afternoon. But he doesn't have much breathing room. John Baker from Kotzebue and Warren Palfrey from British Columbia are only about 20 minutes behind. Ray Reddington Jr. and Zach Steer and Paul Gebhardt are also close behind. A number of teams are resting at Rainy Pass, including Hans Gott, Sim Smith, Ali Zirkel, and Jeff King. Mushers this year will not be getting a lot of sleep on the trail. The 1,000-mile race is known for pushing mushers to the extremes of sleep deprivation. But as APRN's Annie Fite reports, the top contenders are expecting even less shut-eye than usual this year.
At the race start this year, Whitehorse musher Sebastian Schnula was already preparing for a speedy Iditarod, and he seemed ready to accept the consequences.
I kind of think I can forget about sleep.
Schnula says he usually gets about 4 hours of sleep each night during the 1,000-mile races. He didn't participate in this year's Yukon Quest, but he watched with interest as sleep time for the leaders plummeted to a new low. Hans Gott, also from Whitehorse, won that race in record time.
That was probably the race where I slept the least in my whole career. Like, I counted it up, it added up to 5.5 hours in 9 days.
Gott doesn't rely on any caffeine to keep him awake. He says stimulants just make him feel worse. Most mushers say they're conditioned to function on little sleep, but the human body does need some rest. As sleep deprivation sets in, even simple tasks can seem overwhelming. Sheep Mountain musher Zach Steer says pushing the no-sleep boundary too far can be disastrous.
Mushers are facing that dilemma. We are doing a lot more on even less rest, and it does affect our performance and our attitudes. And so for me, it's really important to get my run-rest schedule to minimize the amount of time that I'm running in the very middle of the night. Because that, you know, no matter how tired I am, if it's 3 a.m, I'm even more tired. So as much as I can, I try to set it up so I'm stopped, whether on the trail or at a checkpoint during that time of the day. Try to do as much of the running, either during daylight hours if it's not too hot, or early morning or late evening.
Of course, as mushers cut their own sleep time, that means they're also taking away rest from their dogs. Steer placed 4th in this year's Yukon Quest, opting to give his dogs more rest than the lead mushers. He says the dogs are capable of a lot, but there is a limit to what they can do.
I don't know if we're there yet. I think the Quest allowed us to do a very extreme and rugged schedule, but the Quest also had a very good trail and fairly good weather conditions. I think that the strategy of minimizing rest will not work if the trail conditions or the weather gets very difficult at the end of the race. And so it's a risk that you take in the beginning.
Kasilov musher Paul Gebhardt was one of the first to push the dogs toward longer runs. He points out the strategy hasn't resulted in faster times overall to Nome. Martin Boozer's 2002 race record still stands, but he says it has changed the race.
A lot more people are realizing what I realized 15 years ago, because I grew up around animals, that these dogs are capable of so much more than what we've given them credit for over the years, or what people have given them credit for over the year. You know, people say, well, you can't run a dog 100 miles without resting. And well, yes, you can, as long as he eats. So they're no different than the human beings, what I see. I've got dogs that don't need rest. I've got dogs that need more rest. So it's the same thing.
Togue musher Hugh Neff counts himself among the humans who don't need much sleep. He didn't even worry about stocking up the night before the race.
I don't need that sort of stuff, though. I mean, people don't realize it, but this is how we live every day. I was up all night until midnight hanging out listening to Hobo Jim last night, and he's like the guy who comes and gives me my pep talks every year.
Neff says he'll have plenty of time to sleep later. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Unicleat musher William Mitty Johnson is a rookie, but his grandfather, Henry Ivanoff, was on the original serum run in 1925.
Things were taking a little bit too long, and they needed another musher in Shaq Tulik to go because of the conditions. So he just up and went and met Leonard Sepala on the Norton Bay ice.
His nickname, Mitty, is from his younger days when his grandmother called him Mr. William, and younger kids who couldn't quite say Mr. called him Mitty, and it stuck. Johnson says his father carried mail and worked for the Army hauling freight with dogs. His father has been gone for many years, but he says dogs have always been in their family.
We plan on continuing that. We don't have to win as long as we keep dogs in part of our culture. It's an inspiring thing. It gives you something to do. It teaches you a lot about responsibility. And it's just great to be out there.
Johnson says mushers like John Baker of Kotzebue and Aaron Burmeister have helped him get faster. Johnson says he hopes mushing remains a big part of rural Alaska life.
And I encourage younger people to get into the sport. It might be hard, and that's the way things go. It's a lot of responsibility, but if they can manage raising a dog team, even with 5 dogs, they could probably manage anything.
Johnson says he's looking forward to seeing friends along the coast and on the Yukon, and he plans to make it all the way to Nome. The State Board of Game voted late Friday to eliminate the buffer zone on state land along the eastern boundary of Denali National Park. The buffer has been in place to prevent hunting and trapping of wolves that range outside park protection. The board also placed a moratorium on any new proposals on buffer zones there for 6 years. The decision stunned Alaskans who favor protection of the wolves and was a big disappointment to Denali Park officials. Chris Pfister is a park spokeswoman. She says NPS for the first time submitted their own proposal seeking an expansion of the buffer zone.
Because of data that we presented to the Board of Game indicating that so many more wolves have been taken over there within recent years, and by not increasing the buffer, there would be significant impacts to the wolf population. And by completely removing the buffer, we expect those impacts to be even higher.
Pfister says the wolves are important to both Alaskan and out-of-state visitors who want an opportunity to see wolves in the wild, but rarely are afforded that chance anywhere else but Denali National Park.
By completely removing the wolf buffer, this increases the likelihood of more wolves being killed legally outside of the park from the 2 most visible packs within the park. And this makes it less likely that visitors will see a wolf. And those visitors include not only folks from out of state, but also people within the state. It makes it less likely visitors will see a wolf within Alaska while they're here.
Denali Wolf Protection Advocate Rick Steiner says beyond the 400,000 visitors to Denali Park who wish to view wolves, the scientific value of the Denali wolves is immense. Steiner says they are the longest studied wolves anywhere in the world.
Adolf Murray in the 30s and 40s, and then Gordon Haber starting in the 60s up until his death last October, and the Park Service itself. You know, these are very, very intensively studied wolf populations, so they have scientific value to study.
Steiner says the written testimony at the board's meeting was overwhelmingly in support of retaining or expanding the protection area. Steiner says he went through the official written comment booklet at the meeting, and 156 comments supported expanding the buffer zone, and 3 proposed eliminating it.
It's not a popularity contest. It's not how many proposals come in on a certain issue. It's the range of things that can be considered that they discuss, and then they make a choice.
Kathy Harms is a Department of Fish and Game spokeswoman. She says while some board members thought it was wrong to prevent hunting and trapping on any state lands, others on the board felt it wouldn't be a problem to leave the buffer in place. Only 3 or 4 trappers work the area.
The pendulum go in a variety of directions depending on the politics of the times, who's on the board, what proposals are brought before them. So a few years ago, the closed zone was made larger. This time, It was eliminated. Next time, I'm not going to predict.
Denali Parks' Chris Pfister says their only recourse now is to request an emergency closure if they find too many wolves are being taken. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau kids test their skills at the Arctic Winter Games.
Competing with kids from all over the world, Russia and Scandinavia and all those places.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Members of the environmental group Greenpeace unfurled a giant banner in a U.S. Senate building today, criticizing Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. The 20-foot by 4-foot banner had Murkowski's picture and spoofed a dating website, matching her with three companies, Exxon, Chevron, and Georgia-based utility Southern Company. Greenpeace says all are major campaign contributors to Murkowski. Greenpeace Research Director Kurt Davies says lobbyists have too much power in Washington.
It's really another attempt to let the people of Alaska and the people of the country know that the senator is working for the oil companies and the coal-fired utilities and not necessarily for the public interest.
Greenpeace is particularly critical of Senator Murkowski's goal of blocking the Environmental Protection Agency from regulating greenhouse gases. Murkowski doesn't want the EPA regulating pollution from stationary sources like power plants, so she plans to introduce a disapproval resolution into the Senate that would take away the EPA's authority. Murkowski's spokesman Mike Brumis says Greenpeace is trying to quash debate.
This is another desperate attempt by an outside group to distract from the merits of the debate. Senator Murkowski has legitimate concerns about the economic consequences of EPA regulating greenhouse gases.
The three Greenpeace activists who unfurled the giant banner in the Senate Hart building today were arrested by Capitol Police and charged with a misdemeanor for unlawful conduct. They entered the Senate building and, before going through security, released dozens of helium balloons, which carried their banner to the top of the building's open atrium. It hovered directly across from Senator Murkowski's office until maintenance staff pulled it down. Only one Southeast project is slated for funding in the next round of Alaska Renewable Energy Fund grants. It's work toward a small hydropower plant for Huna. But another 14 projects are on a secondary list that could be funded if the legislature decides to spend more money than the governor wants. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
The Alaska Energy Authority recently released a list of 22 projects it says should receive a total of $25 million from the state's Renewable Energy Fund. Lawmakers need to approve the list, but the hydro, wind, biomass, and geothermal projects are considered likely to win grants. The list includes $850,000 toward a projected $8.5 million effort to build a small hydropower plant in Huna. The Tlingit Village, about 40 miles west of Juneau, is dependent on diesel. No dams will be built. Peter Bibb of the Inside Passage Electrical Cooperative says it will draw from two waterways, Gartenia and Water Supply Creeks.
We're going to bring both of those creeks via a pipeline into one common powerhouse. You know, ideally, I think we'll be lucky to get one of those built sooner than later, and then be prepared to add the other one on as funding comes.
The full project could reduce diesel power generation by 60%, but Bibb says both water sources have problems.
The Cartina, guess what we found in that creek? Fish. Obstacle, but I'm confident with the help of the people we have, we're going to get beyond that. Water Supply Creek. City of Huna gets their water supply from that creek. We want to use it also. So we're working diligently with the city, and we're trying to find ways to both use that water for the city and also to power the electric generators.
Hoonah does not have a lake that could be tapped for a larger hydro project. It was slated to be connected to Juneau's electrical grid, but high costs of a lengthy submarine cable pushed that project off the table. The small hydro plant is the only Southeast project listed in the first $25 million of renewable energy grants. Alaska Energy Authority program manager Peter Krimp says some other towns face even higher power prices.
The scoring for the Renewable Energy Fund projects takes into account, first of all, the cost of energy in a community. And generally, Southeast, with fairly inexpensive power, at least in many of the communities, from hydroelectric, generally scores a little bit lower than other communities in the state.
The Alaska Energy Authority recommended another 46 small projects be funded if lawmakers expand grants from $25 million to $50 million this session. 14 of the projects are in Southeast. One is $90,000 toward the Neck Lake project near Whale Pass, a remote town on northeast Prince of Wales Island. Bob Grimm is president of Alaska Power and Telephone Company, the project's developer.
It's a small run-of-the-river hydro. It would be adjacent to a fishery cost recovery station. The Forest Service had actually performed a study back in 1984 to power a work camp. And we became aware of that work and began looking at it as a solution for Whale Pass, which is entirely dependent upon diesel generation right now.
Two major hydro projects are included for study on the second tier list, Ketchikan's Whitman Lake at $2 million and Sitka's Tackett's Lake at $1.3 million. Smaller hydro efforts are Angoon's Thayer Creek project at $1 million, Tenakee Springs Indian River plant at $200,000, and a run-of-the-river project at Elfin Cove at $350,000. The company is also listed for about $500,000 to study the hydro potential of Conley and Shuby Lakes near Haines, and it's in for another $2 million for a 12-mile transmission line to the Reynolds Creek Power Plant near Heidelberg. With help from Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The first steps towards separating oil taxes from gas taxes are ready for formal consideration, and they'll begin tomorrow. Two bills were introduced in the Senate today that will be in front of the Finance Committee for the rest of this week. Committee co-chair Bert Stedman, a Republican from Sitka, says he's not trying to do any more than remove the possible negative effects of combining the two revenue streams and incentives. He calls the option to be considered right now is whether to remove what's called a progressivity element from gas taxes. That's the portion of the tax structure that pegs tax rates to prices of the resource, and Stedman says it's difficult to legislate.
The concern for the last several years has been when we get gas injected into our system, the complexity is going to get ratcheted way up, and then the confusion level along with it, and we're trying to minimize that. So it's early in the process.
The legislation introduced today removes statutory references that base gas value on the energy equivalent of a barrel of oil. It does not change the actual tax rates on either resource.
On the gas line, you know, clearly there isn't the information to set the gas tax available today. You know, that'll come in the future when we have more information.
Stedman is looking for quick action in the Senate. The Finance Committee has already spent 2 weeks on the subject, and the state operating budget will be on their table next week. The bill must also move through the House, where members say it needs to be considered quickly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Matanuska Valley's Matanuska Creamery has received a $200,000 loan from the State Board of Agriculture and Conservation this month. but a legislative report questions the move. Valley Dairy Incorporated, the company that runs the creamery, was established 2 years ago to give Mat Valley dairy farmers a market for their milk. Later that year, the company asked the Agriculture Board for two loans from the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund. The board approved both loans, a long-term loan for $430,000 and a short-term loan for $200,000. A legislative committee looked into the loans and determined last year that the long-term loan was risky. Valley Dairy General Manager and CEO Karen Olson says that's not so.
The collateral that we have pledged for that loan is approximately double what the loan is. So that means that the loan-to-value rate is 50%, which is considered very good even by commercial standards for, you know, people like oil companies or anybody else.
The new money will allow the creamery to pay off the remaining balance of the first short-term loan. The creamery has put more than $900,000 into improving equipment, and that, along with the inventory of cheese that the company holds, is more than enough to provide adequate collateral. Olson says the creamery is the only local outlet for dairy producers, and the refinance helps the creamery keep up with payments to those producers. After exhaustive discussions with insurance companies, the Sioux Valley High School finally has an insurance settlement. The school burned to the ground in June 2007. The new school was built without knowing exactly how much money would be available. KTNA's Sue Dio has the story.
The companies involved, Alliance and Great American, as well as the borough, have been working on an agreement since the school burned to the ground over 32 months ago. John Duffy reports that the total amount received is just over $17.8 million. The school was built with funds from the borough treasury. Now that the settlement has occurred, the borough can sign the agreement with the state for the money that the legislature appropriated after the school burned. With the insurance settlement finally in, Duffy is able to calculate the borough's share for the state grant.
At this point in time, we are estimating that the borough will have to provide approximately $1.8 million in local funds for the local match.
The total amount expended on design and construction of the new school adds up to $24 million, about $6 million more than what the insurance settlement is. The insurance dollars eligible are applied 100%, and any remaining money that needs to be covered will be split with the state, 30% from the borough, 70% from the state. Last week, Superintendent George Troxell explained it by saying that it is not a normal situation.
Because rather than the district being able to set a bond, go to the voters and expect a definite amount from the state upon which the furniture and equipment money is a percentage of, you know, we didn't have that, those finite, definite figures.
Students and teachers moved into the new school on the Parks Highway the first of the year. The $24 million building is the first LEED certified high school in the state of Alaska. The LEED designation, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, provides standards in environmentally sustainable design and construction. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Opening ceremonies for the 21st Arctic Winter Games were held over the weekend in Grand Prairie, Alberta. The international competition pits young people from Alaska, Greenland, and three northern Canadian regions against each other in sports such as skiing, snowboarding, figure skating, and hockey, as well as native games and cultural events. 15-year-old skier Peter Peel is one of about 30 athletes from Juneau going to this year's games. He competed in the Junior Olympics last year and says he could have gone back again, but opted for the Arctic Winter Games instead.
Last year, I had a coach, and she was from Canada, and she was always telling us about how she went to Arctic Winter Games as a coach, and she always telling us how much fun it was, and it was coming up the next year, and got me really interested.
Peel will compete in the Super G and slalom ski events at the Games. A group from Juneau is exploring the possibility of bidding on the 2014 Arctic Winter Games. Mayor Bruce Botello recently named them ambassadors of the city while they are in Grand Prairie. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Jim Powell is on the Arctic Winter Games Team Alaska Board of Directors.
He's been to four of the games and worked at the 1980 Winter Olympics in Lake Placid, New York. He says Juneau has what it takes to be a good host city.
We have the people, the spirit, and the infrastructure to provide the games.
Powell says another ice rink would have to be built, but overall most of the facilities needed to host the games in Juneau are already in place. There are even a few more resources than in 2006, including the Diamond Park Fieldhouse, which Powell says can be used to stage opening and closing ceremonies. Still, he estimates hosting the games will cost around $4 million.
Now, where does the money come from? People ask that. Well, typically, traditionally, it's been the state, feds, local. It's a combination and private donations and proceeds. People pay to get into some of the events. So that's another source of revenue.
Powell says there's a lot of interest in bringing the games to Juneau, including from Mayor Bruce Botello, who has named about eight people ambassadors of the city while they're at this year's Arctic Winter Games.
That was important for him to come out and go, yeah, let's do this. We bid on it before. I think we can do it again.
The ambassadors are mostly parents accompanying their kids to Grand Prairie to compete in the games. Pam Leary's stepdaughter is playing on Team Alaska's girls' hockey team. Leary says she's going in with an open mind, looking to ask a lot of questions about what it takes to put on the games.
Everybody I've spoken to that have been to the games have just told me you're going to be blown away by it, so I'm pretty excited about that. But I want to ask questions of the people who are organizing it in Grand Prairie so I know what is going to be asked of us in Juneau.
The 2014 Arctic Winter Games are supposed to be held in Greenland, but the host city is still a mystery, Powell says, and Greenland's organizing committee hasn't been responsive to questions. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can also find Iditarod pictures, video, and other coverage there. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.